Informed her that he had sold her wrecked car to a salvage yard near Panama City for $1,000, the usual price for a full loss. He claimed to know little about what happened to such vehicles after they landed at salvage yards, but he believed they were either crushed and sent to recycling plants or sold to scrap yards for parts. Two phone calls to the salvage yard netted no information. After lunch, she informed Michael she had a doctor's appointment and would not be back that afternoon. Instead, she drove to Panama City, her first road trip alone. She stuck to the speed limit and tried not to flinch at every car that passed, but it was nerve-wracking nonetheless. Her breathing was labored and a thick knot stayed in her stomach, but she was determined to get there and back. At the salvage yard, she parked in a gravel lot between a tow truck and a battered pickup and asked an old man with a greasy shirt and even dirtier beard about the office. He nodded toward a metal building with dented walls and an open front door. She walked through it and entered a room with a long counter where mechanics purchased used auto parts. The walls were covered with an impressive collection of hubcaps, though one corner was reserved for calendars of semi-nude women. The presence of a pretty lady stopped all transactions. A man with the name Beau stenciled on his shirt smiled and said,
"Well, hello, miss. What can we do for you?"
She smiled, stepped forward, and said, "I'm looking for my car. It was wrecked 3 weeks ago on the Tapakola Reservation and brought here. I'd like to see it and retrieve some personal items."
Beau stopped smiling and said, "Well, if it was brought here, then it's not your car anymore. I'm assuming it was totaled."
"Yes. I've talked to my insurance company and was told it was here."
Beau stepped to a computer screen and asked, "Do you have the VIN?"
She handed over a photocopy of her title. He punched some keys as his pal Fred joined him. Two mechanics watched closely from the other end of the counter. Beau and Fred frowned and mumbled and seemed confused. Beau said,
"This way,"
and left the counter. Lacey followed as they walked along a short hall and through a side entrance. Behind the building, and kept from view by a tall fence, was a field of mangled cars, trucks, and vans, hundreds of them. In the distance, a massive, clumsy machine was crushing a wrecked vehicle. Beau waved at another man, and he eventually walked over. He wore a white shirt, one much cleaner than Beau's or Fred's, and without a name on it, and he seemed to be in charge. Beau handed him a sheet of paper and said,
"She's looking for that Prius that came from the Indian reservation. Says it was hers."
The man frowned and shook his head.
"It's not here. Some guy showed up a few days ago and bought it for cash. Took it away on a flatbed hauler."
Lacey, way out of her league, asked, "Who bought it?"
"Can't say, ma'am, and really don't know. Don't think he ever gave a name, just wanted the car and had the cash. Happens all the time. These guys will buy a wreck and sell off the parts. Never seen this dude before."
"And there are no records." Beau laughed, and his boss grinned at her ignorance. The boss said,
"No, ma'am. Once a car is totaled and the title is invalidated, no one cares what happens to it. Cash sales are not unusual in this business."
She wasn't sure what to ask next. She assumed they were telling the truth. She looked at the acres of wrecked vehicles and realized that a search would be fruitless.
"Sorry, ma'am,"
the boss said, and walked away. The text from Verna read, "You wanna talk?" They exchanged a few more messages and agreed on a time. Lacey arrived at the Hatch home after dinner. Verna was alone with the kids. The older two were doing homework at the kitchen table. Pippin and the toddler were asleep. Verna said the house had not been that quiet since before Hugo died. They sipped green tea on the patio and watched fireflies in the darkness. Verna was relieved that the relatives had finally cleared out, though her mother would be back tomorrow to help with Pippin. Verna was exhausted but sleeping more. She still awoke with the dream that Hugo was with her, but managed to work her way back to reality. With four kids, she did not have the luxury of proper mourning. Life was not slowing down. She said,
"I got the life insurance check today, so the pressure is off. For now, anyway."
"That's great, Verna."
"We'll be okay for a year or so, but I'll have to find a job. Hugo made $60,000 a year, and we never saved a dime. I need to bury some of this money for the future, for the kids."
She wanted to talk, and she wanted a listener who was not in the family. Her degree from FSU was in public health, and she'd been a social worker for a year or so before her first pregnancy. After the third, she put away any thoughts of a career. She said,
"I like the thought of a job. I've been a full-time mother for a long time now, and I'm ready for a change. Hugo and I talked about this often, and we had decided that as soon as Pippin was in preschool, I would go back to work. Maybe with two salaries we could swing a bigger house, maybe start saving for the kids. Hugo was so supportive, Lacey. He had the big ego and all that. He couldn't help it. But he was not threatened by a working wife."
Lacey listened and nodded. Verna had talked of a career a dozen times. Verna took a sip of tea and closed her eyes for a moment. She snapped out of it with,
"Can you believe I've already had folks asking me for money? So far, two of Hugo's cousins hung around here long enough to ask for a loan. I said, hell no, and got rid of them. But they'll be back. What is it about people that makes them do horrible things like that, Lacey?"
The question couldn't be answered. Lacey responded with, "I don't know." Verna said,
"I got way too many people giving me advice these days. Even before the funeral, everybody knew I was getting $100,000 in life insurance, and some of these leeches were already trying to worm their way in. I'm sick of them, really. Not my mom or my sisters, but some of these cousins, some of these folks Hugo and I have barely seen in the past 5 years."
Geismar said there were some lawyers in the house, plotting lawsuits.
"I got rid of them, too. One big mouth said I could collect from the insurance policy that covered the stolen truck. Turns out that's not the case. When a vehicle is stolen like that, the policy becomes void, at least as far as liability. Lots of big lawsuits got kicked around. One was against Toyota for the faulty airbag and seatbelt, but I'm not sure that's a good idea."
"Got a question, Lacey.
When you and Hugo drove to the casino that night, was his seatbelt working?"
"Not really. He complained because it wouldn't stay latched. This had never happened before. He fiddled around with it and several times got it to click into place, but something was wrong with it."
"You think someone tampered with it?"
"I do, Verna. I believe the airbag was disarmed and the seatbelt was somehow compromised."
"And the accident was not an accident?"
"No, it was not. We were deliberately hit by a truck that weighed twice as much as the Prius."
"But why? You gotta tell me, Lacey. I deserve to know what's going on."
"I'll tell you as much as I can, but you must promise to keep it quiet."
"Come on, Lacey. You know me."
"Do you have a lawyer?"
"Yes. One of Hugo's friends from law school is handling everything. I trust him."
"Okay, but not even he needs to know the story. Not now. Tell me, please." It was almost 10 when Roderick opened the door and said,
"Mom, Pippin's crying.
Verna quickly wiped the tears from her cheeks and said,
Well, what a surprise. That child.
As the women stood and walked inside, Lacey said, I'll stay tonight, okay? I'll take care of Pippin, and maybe we can talk some more.
Thank you, Lacey. I have some more questions.
I'm sure you do. Chapter 24. The meeting took place in the FBI's Tallahassee office, a 10-minute walk from BJC. The supervisor was an unsmiling career man named Luna, and from the moment they gathered around his wide conference table, he seemed to doubt the importance of the meeting. To his right was a handsome and affable special agent named Pacheco, mid-30s, no wedding band, and eyes that seemed to swallow Lacey the moment they said hello. At the far end of the table, as if needed but not really wanted, was the third agent, Han. Lacey faced Luna and Pacheco, with Geismar to her right. She began with, First, thanks for your time. We know you're busy and this will not be quick. Do we have time constraints here?
Luna shook his head and said, No, we're listening.
Good. On the phone yesterday, I asked you about a man named Von Dubose. We're curious as to whether you know anything about him. Pacheco picked up a sheet of paper and said,
Yes, well, not much. Dubose has no criminal record, state or federal. The Catfish Mafia, or Coast Mafia, as it came to be, has been known to us for a long time. I think you have its history. A small gang with a colorful past, but nothing of record here in Florida. About 20 years ago, a man by the name of Duncan was caught with a truckload of marijuana near Winter Haven. DEA suspected he was working for an organized group, probably the same Coast Mafia. But they got nowhere because Duncan wouldn't talk or negotiate. He served a long sentence and was paroled 3 years ago. Never said a word. That's about it. As far as the man known as Von Dubose, we have yet to find anything.
Luna added,
So as far as we're concerned, there's really no outfit known as the Coast Mafia. We spend our time these days focusing on known entities. Al-Qaeda, narco-traffickers, nice guys like that.
Lacey said, Okay. We have an informant who we've grudgingly come to believe is telling the truth. He's a former lawyer, a convicted felon, and he seems to know where the bodies are buried. Not literally, of course, but he's convinced there is an organized gang with Dubose firmly in control. The informant contacted us about 2 months ago. Pacheco asked,
This is Greg Myers.
Yes. That's the name in the complaint I sent over yesterday, but that's a new name, not his real one. According to Myers, Von Dubose and his brother got shot up in a bad drug deal many years ago in South Florida. The brother died, Von did not. No record of that? Pacheco was shaking his head.
Nothing. How would Myers know this?
I have no idea. He is on the run and very secretive.
Who is he running from?
Luna asked. Not sure, but not you or any branch of law enforcement. When he pled guilty, he squealed on a bunch of people and now he feels threatened. Pacheco said,
Were his charges federal?
Yes, they were, and he served time in a federal facility. But please, for reasons I may be able to give you later, don't waste your time trying to find the real Greg Myers. He is not the reason we are here. You've read the formal complaint that's been filed against Judge McDover. We did our assessment and felt it had merit. The real story goes much deeper than what's in the complaint. According to Myers, Von Dubose and the Tapakola tribe struck a deal almost 20 years ago to build a casino, and they've been skimming off the top since day one. Lots of cash. Some of which is now shared with Judge McDover.
The judge is taking cash?
Luna asked. Yes, according to Myers.
And why would they give her the cash?
The formal complaint is our Exhibit A. You have a copy. Here is our Exhibit B. Geismar slid copies across the table. Lacey continued. It's a concise summary of the Tapakola, their land, their federal recognition, and their efforts to build a casino. It involves at least two murders and a man named Junior Mace, who is now sitting on death row at Stark. I suggest you take a few minutes and read the exhibit. They were already reading, slowly. So far, the story had their attention. Methodically, they flipped pages, with Pacheco a bit quicker on the draw. At the far end, Han plowed through in silence. The air was heavy as they weighed every word. Lacey scribbled meaningless notes on a legal pad, while Michael read emails on his phone. When they finished, Lacey said, "Our Exhibit C is a rather detailed history of the construction of the casino, the building of a toll road, and all of the litigation that surrounded both. With a judge in his pocket, DuBose was able to fight off anyone who got in his way, and Treasure Key opened in 2000. Geismar slid across copies of Exhibit C.
"And you want us to read this now?"
Luna asked. "Yes."
"Okay. Would you like some coffee while we read?"
"That would be nice, thanks." Han snapped to attention and hustled off to find a receptionist. The coffee arrived in real mugs, no paper. But neither Luna nor Pacheco seemed to notice. They were lost in Exhibit C. Pacheco finished first, and rather than interrupt his boss, he made notes in the margins and waited. Luna lowered his copy and said,
"A question. This Junior Mace on death row, are we to suspect that maybe he did not commit the two murders referenced in the earlier exhibit?"
Michael replied,
"Frankly, we don't know. But Greg Myers believes Mr. Mace was framed and is innocent."
Lacey added, "I've met with Mace on death row, and he certainly claims to be innocent." Pacheco quipped,
"Doubt if he's the only one there who says he didn't do it."
Smiles, but no laughs. Luna glanced at his watch, stared at the paperwork in front of Geismar, and asked,
"How many of these exhibits do you have?"
"Not many,"
Lacey said. "Well, in Exhibit D, you meet the judge." Geismar slid them over. "First, you'll see photos of her at one of her condos at Rabbit Run." Pacheco looked at the photos and said,
"She's not exactly posing for the camera. Who took these?"
"We don't know," Lacey said. "Greg Myers has an informant, whose name we do not know because Myers doesn't know. They correspond through an intermediary." From the far end, Han exhaled as if in disbelief. "It's a complicated story, and it only gets better," Lacey said, glancing at Han. "Back to the exhibit. There's some background on McDover, not much, though, because she keeps a low profile. Her partner in crime, or one of her partners, is an estate lawyer in Mobile named Phyllis Turbin. Her photo was taken from the local bar directory. These women go way back, are very close, like to travel in style, and always together. They spend far more than they earn. The exhibit summarizes their travel over the past 7 years." Obviously intrigued, the three agents were already zipping through D. The room was silent again as they flipped the pages. Lacey's coffee cup was empty. They had been at the table for an hour, and she was delighted at the reception so far. She and Michael did not know what to expect coming in. They assumed the story they were about to tell would be captivating, but they had no idea how it would be received. Now they had the FBI's attention. Though the agents were conscious of time, they seemed to be in no hurry. Luna was looking at her.
Next.
Next is Exhibit E, the thinnest one so far, and it's a timeline of our involvement in the case, she said as Geismar spread more paperwork. They read it thoroughly. Pacheco asked,
How did McDover react when she was served with the complaint?
She was pretty cool, Lacey said. Denied everything, of course.
Michael said, I thought she looked scared, but my two colleagues disagreed. Not sure that it matters that much.
Pacheco said,
Well, she must be guilty of something if she hired Edgar Killebrew.
Hans surprised them with,
That's my first reaction. What a shyster.
Luna raised a hand slightly to cut him off and asked,
One more exhibit?
Lacey replied, Yes, the last one. I'm sure you saw that our colleague Hugo Hatch died in a car wreck on the reservation. They nodded sadly. Well, I was driving the car when it happened. I'm wearing a scarf because my head was shaved in the hospital. I had cuts and abrasions, a bunch of stitches, a concussion, but I was lucky. I don't remember much about it, but things are coming back. Anyway, my friend and colleague died at the scene, and his death was not an accident. We believe he was murdered. Geismar slid over copies of F, which they grabbed with a bit more eagerness. Photos of the Prius and the Dodge Ram, photos of the scene, summaries of conversations with the constable, a description of the airbag and seatbelt that didn't work, the missing phones and iPad, and the conclusion that someone was behind the accident, thus the murder, and that someone was Von Dubose and his gang. She and Hugo allowed themselves to be lured to the backside of the reservation with the promise of information and got ambushed. The motive was to frighten them, to intimidate them, to show them that they were in way over their heads, and that Dubose would resort to any measure to protect his empire. According to Myers, and they had no reason to doubt him, no one with authority had ever snooped around the casino and asked questions. BJC was the first, and Dubose moved decisively to send a message. He knew the limits of BJC's investigative authority and assumed, correctly, that the agency had almost no crime-fighting capability. He assumed a good scare would scatter them.
Wow,
Pacheco said as he put down the exhibit.
You're not pulling any punches.
We have a dead friend, she said, and we're not going away. Michael said,
But at the same time, we do not have the resources or the authority to fully investigate this corruption. That's where you come in.
For the first time, Luna showed a hint of either fatigue or frustration. He said,
I don't know. This could be an awfully big case.
If Luna showed reluctance, Pacheco seemed ready to sign on.
It's a massive case,
he said with another smile in Lacey's direction. It is, she said, and far too big for us. We simply cannot investigate organized crime. Our world revolves around judges who've cracked up and done stupid things. They violate ethics, but rarely break laws. We've never seen a case like this. Luna shoved his pile of paperwork away and locked his hands behind his head.
Okay, you're not a cop, but you are an investigator. You've lived through this for the past several weeks. If you were us, Ms. Stoltz, how would you proceed?
I'd start with the murder of Hugo Hatch. Sure, I'm emotionally involved with it, but solving it might be easier than trying to penetrate 100 offshore entities and chasing the money. Someone stole the truck. Perhaps another person was driving it. They were working for an organization, for a boss who ordered the hit. Oddly enough, I think the murder was a gift. Dubose overplayed his hand, overreacted, and did something that could come back to bite him. He's lived his entire life in a world of violence and intimidation. Sometimes those guys go too far. He felt threatened, and his instinct was to hit hard.
Pacheco asked,
"And there's no doubt the two cell phones and your iPad were taken?"
"No doubt at all. They obviously wanted the devices for information. But the theft was also a warning. Perhaps Dubose wanted to drop a not-so-subtle hint that they were there, at the scene."
"And you know they were at the scene?"
Pacheco asked gently.
"Yes. I don't recall much, but I remember someone moving around, someone with a light of some sort attached to his head. The light hit my face for an instant. I can remember the sound of footsteps on broken glass. I think there were two men moving around, but again, I was barely conscious."
"Of course you were,"
Pacheco said.
Lacey continued,
"The wreck will not be thoroughly investigated by the Tapacola. The constable has already been replaced, and the new guy happens to be the son of the chief. We can assume they are compromised and eager to close the book on just another tragic car accident."
"You're assuming the chief is in bed with Dubose?"
Luna asked.
"Definitely. The chief rules like a king and knows everything. It's impossible to believe they're skimming cash without his involvement."
"Back to these phones," Pacheco said. "You're certain they got no intel from them?"
Michael replied,
"Yes, the phones are issued by the state. They have or had the usual 5-digit passcode, but after that there was an encryption barrier. Our tech guys are sure they are secure."
"But anything can be hacked," Luna said.
"And if they were somehow able to do so, what would they find?"
"It would be extremely damaging," Michael said. "They would have the phone records, a trail of all the phone calls, and they would probably be able to find Greg Myers."
"And Mr. Myers is still alive and well, I presume?" asked Luna.
"Oh, yes," Lacey said. "They're not going to find him. He was here in Tallahassee 2 weeks ago. Stopped by my apartment to see how I was doing. All of his old phones are at the bottom of the ocean, and he has a supply of new burners."
"And your iPad?"
Pacheco asked. "There's nothing on it that would help them. All personal stuff." Luna pushed his chair back and stood. He stretched his legs and said,
"Han?"
At the far end, Han was shaking his head and eager to contribute. "Perhaps he's the secret weapon," Lacey thought. He said,
"I don't know. So we swoop in with half a dozen agents. What happens then? The cash vanishes into their network of foreign accounts. The skimming stops. The Indians are terrified of Dubose, and everyone clams up."
Pacheco mumbled,
"I love it."
Lacey said, "I wouldn't do that. I would quietly go about the task of finding the driver of the truck. Say you get lucky and grab the guy. He's looking at spending the rest of his life in prison, so he might want to talk. To deal."
"Witness protection?" Pacheco asked.
"That's your game, and I'm sure you guys know how to play it." Luna returned to his seat, shoved the paperwork even farther away, rubbed his eyes as if suddenly fatigued, and said,
"Look, here's our problem. Our boss is in the Jacksonville office. We make a recommendation to him, and he makes the decision. Part of our job is to estimate the manpower and number of hours this case might ultimately consume. Frankly, it's always a waste of time because the target is steadily moving and it's impossible to know where an investigation might go. But rules are rules, and this is, after all, the federal government. So our boss looks at our recommendation. Right now, he's not thinking about a little graft at an Indian casino. He's probably not going to be too impressed with a car wreck that could have been something else.
No, these days we're fighting terror.
We spend our time tracking sleeper cells and American teenagers who are chatting with jihadists and homegrown idiots who are trying to assemble the ingredients to make bombs. And I gotta tell you, there's a lot of bad stuff going on. We're understaffed and often feel as though we're getting further behind. We never forget that we were 24 hours late at 9/11. This is our world. This is the pressure we're under. Sorry for the speech.
For a moment, no one said a word. Michael broke the silence with,
I think we understand. But organized crime does go on.
Luna actually smiled and said,
Sure it does. And I think this is a perfect case for the FBI. But I'm not so sure our boss will agree.
Is it fair to ask what your recommendation will be? Lacey asked.
It's fair to ask, but I can't give you an answer right now. We'll kick it around here for a couple of days, then send it to Jacksonville with a report.
His body language suggested he didn't want to get involved. Pacheco's suggested he was ready to whip out his badge and start grabbing witnesses. Han revealed nothing. Lacey collected her papers and placed them into a neat stack. The meeting was over. She said, Well, thank you for listening. You've been very generous with your time. We will proceed with our investigation and wait to hear from you. Pacheco walked with them out of the office and rode with them on the elevator, eager to spend as much time with them as possible. Michael watched him carefully. When he and Lacey were alone in his car, he said,
He'll call you within 24 hours, and it will have nothing to do with the casino.
You're right, Lacey said.
Nice job in there.
Chapter 25. Like clockwork, the receptionist tapped on the door at 9 a.m., and without waiting for a reply, laid the morning mail on Lacey's desk. She smiled and said thanks. All the junk had been culled and set aside for Florida recycles. That left 6 envelopes addressed to Lacey, 5 with proper return addresses. The 6th looked somewhat suspicious, so she opened it first. In a handwritten scrawl, it read, To Lacey Stoltz. This is Wilton Mace. I tried to call, but your phone isn't working. We need to talk, and soon. My number is 555-996-7702. I'm in town, waiting. Wilton. Using her desk phone, she immediately called the number. Wilton answered, and they had a brief conversation. He was in the DoubleTree Hotel, 3 blocks from the Capitol. Had been there since the day before waiting for her call, and wanted to meet face to face. He had important information. Lacey said she was on her way, and promptly relayed the conversation to Geismar, who was being overly protective and irritating her. He agreed, though, that a meeting in a busy downtown hotel held little danger. He was insisting that she advise him of any travel or interviews related to the McDover case. She agreed, but doubted seriously if she would comply, even though her appetite for risk had been severely diminished. As agreed, Wilton met her near the front entrance, and they found a quiet table in a coffee bar at the edge of the lobby. For his trip to the big city, he was dressed exactly as he had been when they met him under his shade tree a few weeks ago. It seemed like a year. Denim from head to toe, beads around his neck and wrists, long hair pulled back into a ponytail. She was reminded of how much he favored his brother. As they waited for their coffee, he passed along his sincere sorrow about Hugo, a man he had liked. He asked about her injuries and said she looked great. How much do you know about the accident? She asked. What's the buzz on the street? His words were just as slow in town as they had been on the reservation. The man was perpetually calm.
Lots of suspicions, he said.
A waitress placed the cups before them. Dark roast for Wilton, a latte for Lacey. After a long pause, she said,
Okay, I'm listening.
The name Todd Short ring a bell?
He asked. Maybe, I guess, somewhere. Help me out.
He was one of the two jailhouse snitches who testified against my brother. At different times before the trial, the cops placed each snitch in Junior's cell, then pulled them out after a day or two. Both lied to the jury and said Junior bragged about killing the son of a bitch he caught with his wife. And for good measure, he killed her, too. It was very effective testimony, and it nailed Junior.
Lacey sipped her latte and nodded. She had nothing to add, and she refused to drag it out of him. He had arranged this meeting.
Anyway, not long after the trial, Todd Short disappeared. So did the other snitch, a punk named Robles. Years passed, and everybody assumed the two had been rubbed out, probably by the same people who killed Son and Eileen. Now, 15 years later, Short has resurfaced, and we have spoken.
A pause as more coffee was consumed. Lacey was about to ask, Are you going to tell me what he said? Wilton glanced around casually, cleared his throat, and said,
I met him 3 days ago, off the reservation. When I saw him, I remembered how much I hated him. I wanted to smash his face with a rock, but we were in a public place, some kind of fried chicken joint. He starts off by saying he's sorry and all that crap. He was a drifter with a drug habit and a criminal record, and his life was going nowhere. He didn't know Robles very well, but he got word not long after the trial that the punk had probably been killed. So he took off. Went to California, where he's been living under a rock ever since. Actually, he cleaned up his act and has had a decent life. Now he's dying of cancer and wants to make nice. Wants to bare his soul and confess his sins.
Which are?
Back then, he was in jail in Sterling facing another drug charge, one that would get him locked up for years. He'd seen prison, didn't want to go back, so he was easy bait for the cops. They offered the deal. The prosecutor agreed to let him plead to something ridiculous, and after a few weeks in the county jail, he'd be a free man. All he had to do was spend a couple of days in the cell with Junior, then testify at trial. I was in the courtroom and saw it all. Short was a great witness, very believable, and the jury ate up every word of his testimony. It was irresistible. Who doesn't like a good story about illicit sex? According to him, Junior enjoyed telling how he came home early, heard noises from the bedroom, realized what was happening, got his handgun, kicked open the bedroom door, and there was his wife and Son Roscoe going at it on the bed. In a rage, he shot Son twice in the head, and when Eileen wouldn't stop screaming, he shot her, too. Then, and this has never made sense, he took Son's wallet and fled the scene. All bullshit, of course. But Short sold the story to the jury. To claim it was an act of passion, an irresistible impulse, would have been to admit to the killings. Since Junior had nothing to do with it, he couldn't use the obvious defense. As I've said, he had a bad lawyer.
Did Short get cash?
$2,000, handed to him by a cop after he testified. He hung around the area for a few weeks, until he heard the rumors about Robles. Then he fled.
Lacey's phone was on the table, muted. It vibrated and she glanced at it.
Why did you change phone numbers?
Wilton asked. These are state-issued phones. My old one was stolen from my car just after the accident. My new one has a different number.
Who took it?
Probably the same people who caused the wreck.
So what does Short want to do now?
He wants to tell his story to someone who'll listen. He lied, and the cops and prosecutor knew he was lying, and he feels terrible about it.
A real hero, Lacey said as she took another sip of her latte and looked across the busy lobby. No one was watching or listening, but these days she couldn't help but notice people. Look, Wilton, this could be a big break, but this is not my case, okay? Junior's appeals have been handled by those guys in D.C., and he's lucky to have such fine lawyers. You need to sit down with them and let them decide what to do with Todd Short.
I've called them a couple of times, but they're too busy. Not a word. Junior's last habeas appeal was turned down 8 days ago. We expect he'll get an execution date pretty soon. His lawyers have put up a good fight, but we're at the end of the road.
Have you told Junior?
I'll see him tomorrow. He'll want to know what will happen now that one of the snitches is recanting. He trusts you, Lacey. And I do, too.
Thanks, but I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, and I have no idea if any of this is relevant after 15 years. There are limitations on bringing up new evidence, but I don't know the law. If you're looking for advice, I'm the wrong person, the wrong lawyer. I would help if I could, but this is way out of my league.
Could you talk to his lawyers in D.C.? I can't get through.
Why can't Junior talk to them?
He says somebody is always listening in prison. He thinks the phones are tapped. And he hasn't seen the D.C. lawyers in a long time. He thinks they might be forgetting about him now that the end is in sight.
I disagree. If a snitch appears with a different story and swears under oath that the cops and prosecutor knew he was lying, and he got paid cash, believe me, the D.C. lawyers will be excited.
So you think there's hope?
I don't know what to think, Wilton. Again, this is not my field.
He smiled and went silent.
A rodeo team in matching boots and Stetsons paraded through the lobby, their identical roller bags whining in a dull chorus. When they were finally gone and the racket was over, he asked,
"Have you met Lyman Gritt, the ex-constable?"
"No. I hear he's been replaced. Why?"
"He's a good man."
"I'm sure he is. And why bring up his name?"
"He might know something."
"Do you know what he might know, Wilton? Don't play games with me."
"No, I don't. He got fired by the chief. They are at odds. His firing came just days after your accident. There are a lot of rumors, Lacey. The tribe is uneasy. A black guy and a white girl were on the reservation at midnight, digging around for something. He ends up dead under suspicious circumstances."
"Is his being black suspicious?"
"Not really. We're not hung up on skin color. But you have to admit it was unusual. It has been the general belief for a long time that bad people were behind the casino, in bed with our so-called leaders. Now, finally, it might be unraveling. Someone, you and Hugo, dared to show up and start asking questions. He met a tragic end. You came close. The investigation is getting buried by our new constable, who's not trustworthy. Lots of rumors and speculation, Lacey. And now, from nowhere, Todd Short sneaks into the picture again with a different story. It's unsettling, to say the least."
"Wait till the FBI rolls in," she thought. "Promise to keep me posted."
"It depends on what I hear."
"I'll call the lawyers in D.C., she said. "It's the least I can do."
"Thanks.
And say hello to Junior."
"Why don't you go see him? He doesn't get many visitors, and it looks like he might be nearing the end."
"I'll do that. Does he know about Hugo?"
"Yes,
I told him.
Tell him I'll try and stop by as soon as I can get away.
He'll like that, Lacey.
Lacey reported the meeting to Michael, then did a quick review of Junior's file. She called the law firm in D.C. and eventually managed to pull a lawyer named Saltzman out of a meeting. His mega firm had 1,000 lawyers and an excellent reputation for pro bono work. It had spent countless hours representing Junior since his conviction 15 years earlier. She told him Todd Short was back from the dead and now facing a more certain demise. Saltzman was at first incredulous. Short and Robles had been out of the picture for so long, it was almost impossible to believe the news. Lacey confessed her ignorance in this field and asked if it was too late.
Oh, it's late, Saltzman said. Very late, but in this business we never quit. Not until the final moment. I'll be down as soon as I can get there.
It was no real surprise when Special Agent Ali Pacheco stopped by the office for a visit. It was late in the day, and on the phone he said he was just around the corner. Needed only a few minutes. 4 days had passed since the meeting in Luna's office. To their surprise, Pacheco had not called or emailed Lacey. They met in Michael's office, at one end of his cluttered work table. And it was immediately obvious that Pacheco's mood was quite different. His quick smile was missing. He began with,
Luna and I spent yesterday in Jacksonville presenting the case to our boss. Our recommendation was to open an investigation immediately. We agreed with your strategy that the first step should be to try and solve the murder of Hugo Hatch. At the same time, we would begin the rather formidable task of penetrating the syndicate's maze of offshore companies and tracking the money. We would place Judge McDover, Phyllis Turbin, Chief Capel, and Billy Capel under surveillance, and perhaps even obtain warrants to tap their phones and wire their offices. Our recommendation projected the need for 5 agents initially, with me in charge of the investigation. This morning, the boss said no, said we simply cannot spare the manpower at this time. I pressed a little, but this guy is decisive and sticks to his guns. I asked if I could be allowed to investigate with perhaps 1 or 2 agents over the next month or so. Again, he said no. Our official answer is no. I'm sorry. We did our best and pushed as hard as we could under the circumstances, though pushing is perhaps not the right word.
Michael seemed unfazed. Lacey wanted to curse. Instead, she asked, Is there a chance things can change if we learn more?
Who knows?
Pacheco replied, clearly exasperated.
Things can change in the other direction, too. Florida is a favorite point of entry. Always has been. We're getting flooded with tips about illegals sneaking into the country. And they're not coming here to wash dishes and lay concrete. They're organizing homegrown talent to wage jihad. Finding, monitoring, and stopping them has a far greater priority than the corruption that once got us excited. But let's keep an open dialogue. I'm in the loop. If something happens, I want to know.
If something happens. After he left, Michael and Lacey sat at the work table for a long time and compared thoughts. Their disappointment was admitted, then set aside. Without much in the way of resources, they would be forced to become resourceful. At this stage, their primary weapon was the subpoena. Using one of Sedell's many memos, they decided to prepare a list of the 20 or so cases McDover had decided in favor of the mysterious entities pushing to develop various parts of Brunswick County. 11 of the lawsuits involved the condemnation proceedings that led to the building of the Tapakola Tollway. Since they had great latitude in drafting the subpoena, they decided to request McDover's files for only half of the lawsuits.
requesting her records for all of them would tip their hand and let her know what they suspected. Ask for some of the records now, see what she and her ace legal team were willing to hand over, then go back for more later if necessary. Complying with the subpoena would require hours of time by Killebrew and company, with their expensive meters ticking away. Each lawsuit was on file in the clerk's office in the Brunswick County Courthouse, and Sedell had long since retrieved copies of the voluminous records. They were now perfectly indexed and cross-referenced, and there was little doubt BJC's summaries would be far more organized than anything Killebrew sent over. But all judges kept their own office files that did not become part of the public record. It would be fascinating to see how closely McDover complied. Lacey worked on the subpoena until dark. It kept her mind off the FBI. Chapter 26. Gunther was back. He disrupted a lazy Saturday morning with the news that he was flying down and would be there by mid-afternoon. Though Lacey had nothing planned, she made a feeble attempt to sound busy. He would have none of it. He missed his little sister, was worried sick about her, and repeatedly apologized for not having returned sooner. He knew she needed him. She stood in a window of the General Aviation Terminal and watched the private planes take off and land. At 3 p.m., his expected arrival time, she observed a small twin taxi near the terminal and shut down. Gunther got out alone. His checkered flying career had spanned the past 2 decades and had been interrupted on at least 2 occasions when the FAA jerked his license. He had trouble with authority and had argued with air traffic controllers in flight. Such arguments are never won by pilots, and Gunther found himself grounded. Evidently, he had now finagled some way to retrieve his license. He carried a small overnight bag, which she took as a good sign, as well as a thick briefcase undoubtedly bristling with the workings of important deals. He hugged her fiercely in the lobby, told her she looked great, and seemed on the verge of tears as he went on about how much he missed her. She did a passable job of conveying the same sentiments. As they walked out of the terminal, she said, "So you're back in the air." "Yeah. Those fools at FAA can't keep a good man on the ground. Got my license back 2 weeks ago.
Cute plane.
Borrowed it from a buddy.
They walked to her car, the compact Ford she was still driving, and he commented on its lack of size. "It's just a loaner," she said. "I haven't decided on a new one." Gunther knew everything about cars, and immediately began a dissertation on the various models she should consider. He said,
"If we have time, we should go car shopping."
"That's an idea," she replied.
His current ride was an expensive Mercedes. Lacey could recall a Maserati, a Hummer, a Porsche, a black Range Rover SUV, and there had once been talk of a Rolls Royce. Regardless of the bumps in the real estate business, Gunther had always buzzed around Atlanta in style. He was the last person she knew who'd be helpful in selecting a new car on her budget. They were on the street, in traffic, and her defensive driving was obvious. He asked,
"You okay behind the wheel?"
"Not really, but I'm getting there."
"I've never had a bad wreck. Guess it takes time to get back in the saddle."
"A long time."
"You look great, Lacey," he said for the 3rd time.
"I like your hair. Have you thought about keeping it short?"
"No, not for a second," she said with a laugh. A month after leaving the hospital, her scalp was now covered with a thin layer of fine hair that seemed a bit darker than what they'd shaved. But she wasn't worried. At least it was growing. She had retired the scarves and hats and didn't care if anyone stared. He wanted to know the latest developments in her investigation of the crooked judge and the casino, and Lacey filled in some of the backstory. Gunther could keep a secret and obviously had no one to tell back in Atlanta, but Lacey could not completely ignore the rules of confidentiality. She admitted they had hit a wall when the FBI declined to get involved. This gave Gunther a soapbox, one he didn't yield until they arrived at her apartment. He railed against the federal government, its bloated size and countless agencies and useless bureaucrats and senseless policies. He mentioned his own run-ins with the EPA, EEOC, IRS, even the Department of Justice, though he didn't give details of any scrape with the law, and Lacey didn't ask. How could the FBI, with a million agents and $1 billion, decline to pursue such blatant corruption? A man has been killed, yet the FIBBies refuse to investigate. He was flabbergasted, even angry. Inside, he tossed his bag and briefcase in the guest room, and Lacey offered tea or water. Gunther asked for a diet soda. He had been in recovery for almost 10 years and was well beyond the fragility of early sobriety. His drinking days had been the lore of family legend before turning dark and frightening. At their insistence, he had rehabbed twice and without success. A DUI, a divorce, and a bankruptcy all hit at once. And at the age of 32, Gunther gave up booze and drugs and surrendered to a higher power. He had been radically sober for years, to the point of volunteering in a rehab clinic for teenagers. When asked, he spoke freely of his addictions. Gunther, as she well knew, spoke freely of anything and everything. To keep the conversation away from more sensitive matters, she told the story of her meeting with Wilton Mace at a downtown hotel. This led to a lengthy narrative about the murders of Sunrus Ko and Eileen Mace, and Junior's trials, and so on. That was not her case. Its record was public. Confidentiality was not important. Gunther, like most white people, thought the idea of an innocent man on death row was absurd. Surely Junior was guilty of something or he wouldn't be there. This led to a long and often heated and frustrating conversation about the criminal justice system. The law was Lacey's life, and she understood its flaws. Gunther lived and breathed real estate and making money and had little interest in anything else. He admitted he seldom read a newspaper unless he glanced at the business section. He hadn't heard a word about two recent extremely high-profile DNA exonerations in Georgia, one involving a man who'd served 29 years for a rape and murder committed by someone else. In Gunther's opinion, the prisons were full because of rampant crime. Speaking of business, he had a few phone calls to make, finally. Lacey was exhausted and needed a break herself. She showed him to a small terrace off the kitchen. A wrought iron table was the perfect spot for him to set up shop. For dinner, they chose a Thai place near the FSU campus. After they settled into their seats, Gunther suddenly reached for a pocket and whipped out a cell phone.
"Gotta do this email, sis,"
he said, already tapping away. She watched with a frown. And when he finished, she said, "Here's the deal. All phones on the table, on mute, and the first one that vibrates gets the check."
"I was going to treat anyway."
"I'm sure you will." From her purse, she removed her iPhone and the new BlackBerry issued by BJC. He matched her two with two of his own.
"What's that?"
he asked, pointing to the BlackBerry. "State issue. Its predecessor was the one stolen from the car."
"And no trace?"
"Nothing. Our tech guys said there's no way to hack in. I guess we're safe." She reached for a front pocket of her slacks and said, "Oh, almost forgot." She pulled out the prepaid burner Myers had given her.
You have 3 phones?
Gunther asked. This doesn't really count, she said, placing the burner.